Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics from the Bronze Age, which included such titles as DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, I am joined by a network favorite and my good friend and bat cousin, the man who is too dangerous for a girl, Martin Gray. Martin, welcome to DC Special Cast.
Hello there, Paul. Thank you so much for having me. Tell you what, I may never win a Robbie, but at least I'm on another fantastic Fire and Water Network show.
I don't have a Robbie either. I'm not so much of a movie guy, so that's still out of my reach. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, I've done movies, but I haven't done MASH.
Ah, gotcha. All right, today's comic, listeners, is a favorite. It's DC Special number 27, Danger, Dinosaurs at Large, starring Captain Comet and Tommy Tomorrow. So this is another one from our Patreon poll a few months ago and has been on the list from the very beginning to get to. Martin, I know that you didn't get a lot of these giant-sized specials back in the day on the other side of the pond. Did you have this one when you were a kid? Tell the group why you requested this issue very early on.
Well, actually, I did have this as a kid. It was one of the few that did turn up into the local news agents. And I chose it because, you know, come on, what kiddie doesn't love dinosaurs? I'm still just a big kid. Yeah, and Tommy Tomorrow and Captain Comet were two of my favourite C-list DC characters. Mm-hmm. Captain Comet, he'd been appearing in the Secret Society of Supervillains about the time of this comic. In fact, as a direct tie-in. And I'd read some of his original stories in reprint form. And Tommy, I'd only really read from reprints, which actually is the only way you could because he hadn't been published in news stories since 10, 12 years previously.
Yep.
And the idea of these two classic, I think we'd say Atomic Age heroes teamed up in a new story had me absolutely drooling. Plus, while shorts on comic book characters are always good, how cool is Tommy's tweaked uniform from artist Rich Buckler? It's really great. And another thing, the DC didn't have creator credits on the cover back then, as you know, but I was thrilled inside to see it had the Answer Man himself, Bob Razarkas, writing, and fan favourite Rich Buckler doing the pencils. And on inks, Joe Rubenstein, one of the best up-and-coming inkers that I knew from Legion of Superheroes. So yeah, all in all, you know, as packages go, this was worth my 25 pence.
25p, all right. Excellent. Well, I also had it when I was a kid and looking at the copy that I had back then. But before we go any farther, let's take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. I picked DC Finest Science Fiction, the Gorilla World trade paperback. The connection is obvious. They had a bunch of Tommy Tomorrow stories in here. This was written by John Broom, Gardner Fox, Jack Schiff, and others, with art by Jim Mooney and Murphy Anderson, Gil Kane, Carmine Infantino. And it is the first genre anthology collection featuring classic science fiction stories that have never before been collected. Silver Age weirdness at its best from these legendary talents, starring long-forgotten pulp heroes, Tommy Tomorrow, Captain Comet, and Strange Dimensions, where gorillas rule the world. Stories from Action number 183 to 196. Those are the Tommy Tomorrow ones. Strange Adventures 35 to 48. Mystery in Space 16 to 22. 624 pages. Cover price is $39.99. Inside Trades price $23.19. You save 42%. I have this. I read it when it came out. This was one of the ones I was very most excited about because I'd never read any of these stories. Maybe I'd read a couple of them in reprints. There is a little bit of Tomahawk going on because there's only two stories with gorillas in them. But it's a great collection. I highly recommend it.
Oh, I tell you, only two stories with gorillas, but there's a wonderful story about a couple who go on a space honeymoon.
Oh, yes.
Worth the price of admission. But yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant pick, Paul. I'm a huge fan of the DC Finest. I've got about 12 of them so far and hope to buy some more.
They're great.
Yeah, so my pick's another book from the series, one featuring Silver Age goodness. While you have the book with a smattering of Tommy Tomorrow and Captain Comet strips, I've got the one with a showcase for Adam Blake's bestie as seen in this very issue, Hawkman. What we have is Hawkman, Wings Across Time from DC Finest, collecting the earlier stories of Katta and Shearer Hall from The Brave and the Bold, Hawkman, Mystery in Space, and there's a team up from The Atom. is featuring the work of writer Gardner Fox, artist Joe Kubert and Murphy Anderson, and the collection usually retails as $39.99. You can get this for $23.99 in stock trades, a discount of 40% for a lot of pages. I haven't written down how many pages, but it's pretty much the same as yours, I would imagine.
Yeah.
They're always about 600 plus. I mean, the biggest bargain in comics, I'd say.
Yeah, they're a great series. I love them. I've bought almost all of them. I know my podcast partner, Sean, he's, I think, buying everyone.
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty exciting. All right, let's get back to our comic. It's DC Special number 27, as I mentioned, has a cover date of April-May 1977. Was on sale on January 20th, 1977. I was a 12-year-old boy who loved dinosaurs. Cover price 50 cents or 25p and had 48 pages, of which 34 are the stories, edited by Paul Levitz. Now, this has been reprinted in the Secret Society of Supervillains Volume 2 hardcover from 2012. It also has been reprinted in the Justice League Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 3 from 2021. That's the good news, is you can get this comic. But also, if you want the original, let's start with Wayne Special Investments. There seem to be quite a bit more of these in the market than some of the other books that we've been reviewing on the show. You can easily get a copy online for under $5 with higher grades, maybe 10 bucks. I'm guessing it's because this one sold better or was all new, and who knows, but it seems to be a lot more available than some of the others that we've had on the show. I think you mentioned you have a physical copy, right?
I do, yes. I was 13. I bought it at the time. And I wonder whether it's just so available now because maybe someone in Canada or wherever they were printing at that point overprinted, pressed the wrong button. And that might be why it made it to the UK. Because as you know, normally we didn't see the specials. We never generally saw the first issues or the second issues. Usually things started coming in about issue 4, which would be the Superman guest star issue of anything, Black Lightning and so on. But yeah, so I've got my original copy, which is back down at my dad's house in the northeast of England. But for the purposes of the tape, I did order myself a new copy from an online auction site. Very, very reasonable price, about a tenner, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it smells so very, very good.
And finally, good news, listeners. This issue actually is on DC Universe Infinite. So go ahead and pull it up and read it. We'll wait for you.
Now, that's excellent news. I'm not surprised this is in the Secret Society of Supervillains collection because it ties in. Yeah. But I wonder what on earth it's doing in Justice League of America. Yeah, the Justice League of America turn up for a page. Hawkman's in a bit, tiny bit more. But do you think they were just space page filling?
Well, they wanted to get a third omnibus, maybe. Yeah. What the heck, I guess, right? I'm sure that's why it's on DC Infinite, because it's been digitized.
Oh, it has to be, yeah.
Those of you reading it on DC Universe Infinite, you have that omnibus probably to thank for it. Or maybe even that Secret Society collection back in 2012. Who knows? Anyway, for historical context, the most significant DC book on the stands this month is probably Black Lightning number one, Speaking of the Devil, with his first appearance. I must add that we get a Terra Man appearance in Action Comics number 470. For Marvel, we got What If number two, What If the Hulk Had the Brains of Bruce Banner, and an awesome Dave Cockrum cover on Spectacular Spider-Man number 5. This is the one where he's hanging limply from his web and his wrist with his costume all battle damaged, with the Vulture closing in. Great cover. Martin, any favorites for you this month?
I've got a few, yeah. I mean, one, well, four that immediately stand out: Captain Britain Weekly issues 14 to 17, starring the hero who was specially made for Marvel UK readers. And the stories, I mean, with Captain Britain back then basically being a cross between Captain America and Thor, the stories were hugely derivative, but I loved them. And this lot features Brian Bannock versus this big bald baddie called Mastermind, not the ex-villain. He met his UK imitator, we'll say, Captain America. Note of historical interest that might excite our pal Sean: the editor of the comic book was one Neil Tennant. Now, you know who Neil Tennant is, don't you?
I don't.
He's half of the future Pet Shop Boys pop group.
Oh, very cool. And he was the editor of Captain Britain? That's very cool.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And he's from the northeast of England like me. Top fella.
How about that? That's cool.
Yeah.
And did you have a lot of these Captain Britain and Marvel UK, that kind of stuff?
I used to buy all the reprints, basically. We'd have weekly reprint comics, which would generally chop up a 17-page comic. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to get new splash pages in the second part, which often weren't good. You'd get the covers repurposed for slightly wider and taller British format, wider British format, I think. But there was one comic called The Titans Weekly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, have you ever seen The Titans Weekly?
I've heard of these. I don't know that I've seen, other than the one time I was over in the UK and I went to a comic shop and, you know, saw some of these. I don't really have a lot of familiarity with the format and the contents of a lot of these, but I've seen Titan comics before. were online.
Yeah, well, these aren't Titan the publisher. This is a Marvel comic called The Titans. Mm-hmm. And what it was, even though with them being weekly, they were fast running out of material, someone had the idea of turning the regular size A4 comic on its side. The thinnest side was where the staple was, and printing two US pages per page. So you'd open up a spread and you'd have four pages.
Wow.
And they'd put more strips in, and they were fantastic reads. And there'd be a pull-out poster in the cover, which is quite often drawn by some upcoming artists, like, you know, Rich Buckler or Jim Starlin. Or they did a second comic, Spider-Man with the Superheroes. After about a year, they packed them in with both because we were just using the material up too quickly. But they were good.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm looking at it now on Mike's. It's great that Mike's has these UK comics on here now, because it's really cool to look at them contemporaneously with the comics that came out.
They're great. And a few other comics that I had that month. There was the Black and White Marvel Preview, which was one of Marvel's more adulty comics, so you would buy it hoping for a bit of flesh in there. That had an adaptation of the pulp writer Philip Wiley's Gladiator story, and I don't know why it was retitled Man God, and I'd always assumed that that was because of the Gladiator character in the X-Men, but this was about 8 months before he first appeared in the X-Men, so I don't know, maybe Roy Thomas just liked the title better. But Thomas and Tony DeZuniga gave us a really meaty read with lovely, you know, black and white washes and gorgeous. Amazing cover by Earl Norem, who did a lot of these Marvel magazines. A seriously sexy cover, whether you go over beefcake or cheesecake. Have you read this one?
I've not read this one. I don't have a lot of these Marvel magazines. I've read some of them in compilations and omnibuses and stuff, like some of the Savage Sword, Conan, but I haven't read this one.
Oh, it's good.
Pretty
cool. Yeah, it's pretty excellent. I think there was a little bit of nookie in between pages on this one. This could just kind of be a bit quicker, but we had Wonder Woman 230, which was a terrific battle between the Cheetah, because for set you in the world, where the second return to World War II. And Sean and I touched on this issue in an episode 9 of his fantastic show, Peacebound and Down.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that the Perez cover was a modest tribute to this cover, which I had never made that connection before. I was very impressed with that connection.
It seemed to be. I mean, obviously, the composition is very, very different, right. Different logo, but Wonder Woman versus the Cheetah, with the Cheetah scratching a poster. And a purple background. It might just have been an unconscious homage or just a coincidence, but it tickled me. I love this sort of thing.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah, plus we have this month, the dazzling debut of Dawnstar and however many little fleas are in her wings in Superboy 226. And the most intriguing comic of the month, because of the cover question, is Green Lantern Green Arrow 94. And the cover blurb proclaims, Green Arrow without a beard? Why? And, you know, I still don't know to this day, Paul.
Well, I have this one, but I haven't read it for about 40 years. I'd have to reread it and tell you.
There's your homework.
That's awesome. That's great. But let's go back to our comic. Martin, do you want to do the honors and tell us about the cover to this special comic and give us your thoughts?
Yeah, the cover. We have the absolutely beautiful DC special logo with the special coming out of the side of the DC bullet. And it says, an all-new spectacular presents Captain Comet. Danger! Dinosaurs at large. And it's just a fantastic one-off logo. And it says, the incredible dinosaur invasion of 1977. And just below the logo, we have Captain Comet in flight, bashing a Tyrannosaurus Rex in the jaw. And below that, on the ground, we have this strange dinosaur man sort of fighting Tommy Tomorrow. And the foot of the Tyrannosaurus Rex is on Tommy's pal, Brent. I mean, a million points to any reader who could have named Brent. he's quite obscure, isn't he? While the visual of Captain Comet bashing the dinosaur has impact, the most striking thing about the cover for me, or one of the most striking things, is the unusual blue background. I don't think I've ever seen that particular blue on a comic book cover. And according to an online cover chart, because of course I have to check, it's called French blue, which I've never heard of.
Oh, I've not heard that either. I did note that it's an unusual color, but I didn't know it was called French blue. That's very cool.
It's lovely. The surprising thing is that even though we have the regular Captain Comet logo inside, on the cover someone just tried to draw it freehand. It's not one of the proper letters like Gaspar Saladino or someone. It's just looking quite tatty. I'm sure they did their best, but they could have just lifted it from the logo library. I don't understand why. Okay, Captain Comet was appearing in SSOV at that point.
Yeah.
But you'd think Tommy Tomorrow would have rated a mention on the cover.
Yeah, been 14 years, like you said. You know, dinosaurs get the biggest logo, right? I mean, that must have been perceived as the better seller than either Captain Comet or Tommy Tomorrow. You know, they're trying to maybe bring back some of these characters and see how they're doing. I've always wondered, when I look at this comic, why do you think dinosaurs didn't sell better than gorillas?
The dinosaurs weren't crying? I don't know. I mean, but I wonder, was this about around the time that we had films like The Land, the Time Forgotten, The People, the Time Forgotten with Doug McClure?
I mean, I guess by the 70s, the whole gorilla thing wasn't so much a thing anymore, although we did get some of those superheroes versus super gorillas in the early 70s and so forth. But it wasn't Julie Schwartz saying, put a gorilla on every third cover. But for me, if I was a kid, I would much rather read stories with dinosaurs in them than gorillas. Maybe because they can't make the dinosaurs talk. They have to do something wacky like they do in this comic to get a dinosaur to be able to talk. Whereas with a gorilla, you can easily imagine a city of intelligent gorillas in the middle of Africa, right?
I mean, I don't want to preempt our discussion because I think we'll be mentioning it when we get to the text pages, but it does seem that the dinosaur was the point of the comic and the heroes was like, well, whoever.
Yeah, that's a good point. You did say that. My favorite on this was the picture of the dinosaur guy, Tyranno Rex, at the bottom fighting Tommy Tomorrow. I just love that. And I have to note, from a historical perspective, I think we now know that Tyrannosaurus Rexes didn't actually stand like that. Back in the 70s, I think they thought they stood on their hind legs with their tail balancing on the ground. But I think nowadays they say that they just walk sort of horizontal and the tail balances off the rest of the body in the front. But who knows?
Honestly, next you'll be telling me that they weren't orange and that they had feathers.
That's right. Yeah, no, I love the cover too. It's very dynamic. Poor Brent getting crushed. Of course, I will post the cover, several other pages on fireandwaterpodcast.com on the gallery page. Before we get to the actual story, though, I thought we were just talking about these hidden heroes. I thought I'd do a little publishing and character profile on Tommy Tomorrow. I got a lot of this information from Wikipedia, but also Toonopedia, which I had not been familiar with before, but it's a pretty neat website. You can check it out. Tommy Tomorrow's first appearance was way back in Real Fact Comics number 6 from January 1947, and it was created by a whole slew of people, including Jack Schiff, George Kasdan, Bernie Breslauer, and Virgil Findlay, with art by Howard Sherman, who also created Dr. Fate. None of them could have possibly known the character had a future. In fact, he was obviously designed as a stereotyped hero to represent a sort of generic future man who might pilot the first rocket to Mars. So, Real Fact was published by DC from 1946 to 49, mostly ran unrelated short bits of nonfiction in comics form, a little like Ripley's Believe It or Not. Apparently, Tommy Tomorrow's trip to Mars was presented as a future vision of space travel. I actually didn't know that. He continued and had four more appearances in Real Fact for four issues, numbers 6, 8, 13, and 16 through 1948. DC would occasionally feature facts about its own characters in Real Fact. A piece on the creation of Batman in number 5. I've seen that Batman. I haven't seen it in person, but I've seen pictures of that Batman one. There was one on the Vigilante movie serial number 10. But Tommy Tomorrow is the only one to go in the other direction and become a DC character after appearing in Real Fact. So I thought that was neat.
Wow, gosh.
Yeah, he then had a long run in Action Comics, which is where most of us would have known from. He had an 11-year run from 127 to 251. So that's a good run, 1948 to 59. Most of these were written by DC mainstay Otto Binder with art by Jim Mooney. And a number of these are in that DC Finest collection I mentioned earlier. And in those stories, he graduated from Spaceport West Point. It's sort of like a West Point in the far future, 1988.
Wow.
And became a colonel in the Planeteers, which was basically a police force for the solar system. Gotham is the capital city not only of Earth, but of the solar system. And every planet and every moon, every asteroid of the solar system seems to have some weird alien life form or sentient race in the series. In action number 149 from 1950, they switched his adventures to be now set in the year 2050, as it was realized by the creators that the 1990s were optimistically too soon for such technology.
Dear.
And by the way, just for those of us who want to feel old, we are now closer to 2050 than we are 2000.
Oh dear. Thank you.
Anyway, Tommy and his pal, Captain Brentwood, who we've been talking about, flew the space lanes in their patrol craft, Space Ace. And although they were officers, they spent their days out in the field pursuing suspects and wearing their Planeteer uniforms, which was an attractive ensemble of purple with yellow trim to match Tommy's hair, consisting of boots, gloves, a long sleeve tunic, and shorts, which of course is my podcast partner Sean M. Meyer's favorite. In 1959, Supergirl supplanted the feature in action, so Tommy moved over to World's Finest for three more years, from 102 to 124, until he was kicked out of World's Finest by Aquaman. But then DC gave him an extensive five-issue tryout as the cover feature in Showcase number 41, 42, 44, 46, and 47 between 1962 and 1963. This run was written by Arnold Drake, of course, co-creator of the Doom Patrol, and artist Lee Elias, former subject of a Bat Family History a couple years ago. In these stories, Tommy was retooled again. Brentwood was dropped, giving Tommy an alien from Venus as a partner, but at least this version got to wear long pants. But then there was nothing until this issue 14 years later. His only other pre-crisis appearance was about a year after this in Showcase number 100, which of course featured all the characters that had appeared in that title to date. So Mike's Amazing World tells us that he had 158 pre-crisis appearances. So there were some other versions post-crisis, and the most well-known version is that the great disaster that created Commandy's world did not happen, but the boy who would have grown up to be Commandy instead grew up to become Tommy Tomorrow. That's kind of canon now, but there were a bunch of other alternative versions too. There was an alternate Tommy Tomorrow in Howard Chaykin's 1990 miniseries Twilight, which tried to bring in all these DC future science space characters. And because Chaykin was kind of like that era's Tom King, he wrote Tommy as kind of a jerk and unbalanced, and he ran the Planeteers very autocratically.
Oh, dear.
And according to Starman 1 Million from 1998, one of the historically significant bearers of the Starman name was Tommy Tomorrow II. So I thought that was kind of neat. And just imagine Stan Lee with John Byrne creating Robin from 2002. A teenager who grew up with Robin was named Tommy Tomorrow. Thought that was kind of neat. I had forgotten that. A strange alien force seemingly colonizing the force of Dimitri, Kansas, makes reference to a major Tomorrow of a group called the Planeteers in 2010's Magog number 7. Now that's a deep cut. It was alluded to in that time that Tommy was going to be a new villain in that series. I presume they never got to it.
Thank God.
Yeah. A Captain Tomorrow appeared in a Star Trek Legion of Superheroes crossover in 2011. That's a nice little nod. And he also apparently appears as a Tomas Tomorra in DC's 2013 Threshold comic by Keith Giffen.
Wow.
So there's some strange, it hasn't really stuck post-crisis other than the Commandy thing, but wow.
Cool stuff. I mean, he must have been very popular with the read, because even though they didn't have letter column until the early 60s, they used to pay attention to, you know, what kids liked, and whenever they were reducing the page count, the less popular character would go. But he just stuck around. I mean, that is a brilliant roundup of Tommy's timelines. I would say that Dr. Ange, our pal, would probably like it to be noted that after Tommy was supplanted in Action Comics by the Maid of Might herself, Supergirl, one issue had Linda travel to the future, where she met a young genius orphan named Tommy, and at the end of the issue she realizes his name was Tommy Tomorrow. And so Tommy was firmly placed in DC continuity.
Yeah, I haven't read that story. That's a great one. I'm sure Dr. Ange does appreciate that.
Last week, I was just checking out a detail about Tommy Tomorrow, because there's something in this issue that says this issue's news story can possibly fit between one of the issues of Action Comics in 1960. So I went and looked at them all thinking there'd be a plot point. It was not there. I just ended up looking at about 2 years worth of Tommy Tomorrow stories, and they're absolute brilliant reads. Some of the Jim Mooney art in there, because he was inking himself, it's just astonishingly good. I mean, I'm used to loving Jim Mooney on Supergirl,
yeah,
which is a lot cleaner and simpler, but on Tommy Tomorrow sometimes it was quite ornate.
That was my favorite art in that DC Finest collection, was the Jim Mooney Tommy Tomorrow art. I agree with you, he was pretty good.
Yeah, there's one issue where he meets this like sleeping space goddess Snow White type. She's just stunning, honest. Mm-hmm. I must not get distracted and try and turn this into the Tommy Tomorrow podcast. Perhaps we can do that later.
The Tomorrow Cast. Let's get to our story. This is written, as Martin mentioned, by our bat cousin Bob Ruzakis, penciled by Rich Buckler, with inks by Joe Rubenstein, colored by Jerry Serpe, lettered by Milt Snappin. So we open in 1977 in the JLA satellite with Captain Comet hanging out and chatting with Hawkman while the latter is on the all-important monitor duty. They are commiserating about being lonely on Earth. Katar is an alien and Adam Blake is a mutant born 100,000 years ahead of his time. But their bro time is interrupted by a comet streaking by, which disrupts all their sensors. But just as quickly as it appeared, the strange comet disappears.
But we also open in 2056 as Tommy Tomorrow and his pal Brent are ferrying one Dr. Schmidt to planet Vega 4 so the scientists can stop an outbreak of space fever. But the mission is interrupted as the same comet speeds past them as well. Unfortunately, it catches their ship in its gravitational wake and drags them along with it. And this is some comet. It not only drags them along in space, but also in time. The Planeteers find themselves 100 million years in the past. They're attacked by a pair of pterodactyls, but manage to land safely. They realize that finding out where the comet landed is likely their way home, and so they set out in search of it.
Meanwhile, back in 1977, dinosaurs start appearing all over the world and wreaking havoc. The Justice League is deployed to help stop the carnage. Hawkman deputizes Captain Comet to stay on the satellite for monitor duty while he goes back down to Earth. And as he dutifully monitors the heroes all over the world facing this threat, Captain Comet sees a Brontosaurus in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. But he sees a costumed character there who he assumes will take care of that problem. Oh, Captain Comet, you hang out with enough villains that you should have done your homework. That is Kronos, and he is assuredly behind this mess.
Back in 100 million BC, the rather small remnant of the comet has crashed in the jungle and happened upon by a T-Rex. The dinosaur is instantly evolved into a humanoid shape, complete with a very fetching leotard outfit and the ability to speak. He names himself Tyrannorex. Of course he does. Shortly thereafter, Tommy Tomorrow and Dr. Schmidt stumble upon Tyrannor, who has built a shrine to his god, the comet, complete with some kind of video screen slash portal showing 1977. Tyrannor sixes dinosaur friends on the planet here.
But back in 1977, Captain Comet checks back in on Sheboygan and notices the other end of the time portal. He figures he will go down there and help this Natalie dressed superhero with the striped pants. They battle some dinosaurs for a bit, and Comet uses his telepathy to realize that Kronos is a villain and behind the whole crisis. He starts shoving the dinosaurs back through the portal and then attempts to close it. This is when Kronos shows his hand. His goal is to capture the time-traveling comet. He has drawn it to the future to harness its time powers, but it overshot its destination. Fisticuffs ensue, of course, and Captain Comet emerges victorious. He strides to the portal to close it up, which of course would trap our planeteers in the past.
Speaking of which, Tommy and Dr. Schmidt are fighting dinosaurs and hightailing it back to the ship. Tommy decides that he wants to fly it and the comet through the portal. They grab the rock with a mechanical arm on the way, but they pick up a stray. Tyrannorex has jumped aboard to stay with his god rock. Captain Comet is using his mental powers to close the rift when he spies Tommy's futuristic ship coming through. The heroes don't have any time to chat since Tyrannorex starts monologuing about his god rock. By this point, Kronos has recovered enough to see the rock and shoots at Tyrannor to get it, but his shots go awry and destroy the rock.
Tyranno instantly reverts back to a regular T-Rex, but Captain Comet is finally able to grab him by the tail and toss him back through the portal where he belongs. They also mop up and capture Kronos. But that's not all. We get a patented Rosacus Roundup last page. Dr. Schmidt is still worried about the plague on Vega 4, but a very Continuity Studios-inspired looking Superman has dropped by to take them back to the future. We close as Hawkman is giving Captain Comet a hard time about leaving the satellite during monitor duty, even though that's exactly what he did. I guess we know now while Captain Comet was never officially invited to join the Justice League. The end. Martin, what did you think of this story?
I just loved it. I mean, I loved it probably more than Dr. Schmidt did because he got his arm bitten by a dinosaur. But yeah, it was just such a fantastic one. I mean, it's a double-sized adventure showcasing two of DC's lesser lights who are no less interesting than their bigger-name contemporaries. Mm-hmm. There's Kronos, who's one of my favourite Silver and Bronze Age villains, not least for his fantastic outfit. Mm-hmm. Cameos from a few JLA members. And again, who doesn't love dinosaurs?
Yes.
Bob Bazarkas and Rich Book are looking to be having a ball. And my only disappointment is that the excellently conceived Tyrannorex is so rubbish. I mean, did he ever appear again? I think that can safely be left as a rhetorical question.
I don't think so.
No, I mean, I can imagine him showing up in Ambush Bug and being mocked. If our pal Isamu happened to be listening to this, Isamu, did Tyrannorex ever show up again?
We'll find out, I'm sure. All right, let's walk through it a little bit. This has got some gems. So we didn't really talk about the splash page at all. The splash page is a sort of split image where you've got Captain Comet fighting Kronos at the top and Tommy Tomorrow fighting Tyrannorex and another dinosaurs in the bottom. But I have to ask you a question. My splash page is miscolored. Captain Comet's face, the elephant, several of the dinosaurs are miscolored, all pink on mine. It was like a pink bleed from either the cover or I don't know where it came from because I tried to line it up with the ad on the inside cover or other place. Is your splash page miscolored as well, or is that just my copy?
No, not only do I have the splash page miscolored, so Captain Comet's got it's totally ugly pink face as if he's a bad Asian, and the yellow costume.
Yep.
It's also got the imprint of the Hostess Twinkie advert. Have you got that as well?
And so that's where I figured it came from, but they don't really line
up.
They
don't, no, they don't at all. No, it's like a double printing cock-up. It looks terrible. Again, I've recently reread this on the DC app. It's probably fixed in there. I didn't notice on there means it's been fixed. That, and I've got this the Super Villains book behind me. I could check, but I think you could probably confirm that it's been corrected.
Yeah. I can log in real quick to DC Universe on my computer and check. But while we're doing that, I do love the art on the splash page. It's got this neat sort of black background. You know, a lot of the story takes place where they're separate, right, until the end. And so it is neat to see that carry through in the splash page.
Really is, because it's just such a engaging opening to the comic. It's funny that you mentioned the continuity comics inspired Superman, because I've got a couple of notes here. They're saying that's a particularly good panel by Rich Buckler. When did Neil Adams draw it?
Yes, exactly.
See, actually, at one point, I went down another rabbit hole of looking at the entire run of X-Men by Neil Adams, about sort of 10 issues or something, thinking, I've seen that head before. Didn't find it in the end.
That's funny. So then we get a really cool double-page spread, sort of. It's got the comet going down from left to right, top to bottom, across the double page spread. And then the top right has got a sequence with Tommy and Brent. And the bottom left has the conversation with Hawkman and Captain Comet. What'd you think of this intro to the situation here?
It's brilliant. I mean, it's a very large, impactful, no pun intended, comet going across the two pages. But it's such a clever way of giving, you know, the two scenarios. I mean, good thinking by Bob Rozakis there, because it just splits them off nicely, yet unifies them with the comets. Yeah. And it just looks brilliant as drawn by Buckler and Rubenstein. Really, really exciting way to start the comic.
And yeah, I just looked it up on DC Universe Infinite, and the splash page is corrected, but they still have the woolly mammoth pink. But all the dinosaurs are unusual colors. One is pink, one is yellow, one is orange. So I don't quite get that choice by whoever recolored the comic for digital, but it is what it is. But the heroes are colored properly, particularly Captain Comet, and the bleeding pages are gone.
Oh, that's good. Also, I liked about the openings is Bob Rozakis taught me as a child, I think, the difference between meteorites and meteoroids.
Why don't you educate us?
Okay, if I've got this the right way around now, a meteoroid in space, and when it touches the Earth, it's a meteorite, I think. I should check that out.
Okay, there you go. I do like, on this double page spread again, both pairs of characters are tumbled out of their seats by the passage of the comet, which I kind of like the parallel nature of this. And I got to think, if Bob Rozakis had ever had the chance to write the Justice League, he would have put in Captain Comet as permanent member for sure. Would have liked to have seen that Justice League is written by Bob Rozakis, right?
Oh, I would definitely. I think he did one filling on Justice League. But anyway, he certainly would drop them into his stories here and there. And I mean, that excellent Detective Comics calculator serial he did with individual members was great. I can now tell you definitively, according to AI, a meteoroid is a rock in space. A meteor is a streak of light seen when a meteoroid burns up in the planet's atmosphere. And a meteorite is a meteoroid that survives atmospheric entry and lands on the ground. There you go.
How about that? Well done, you.
So I think I might have been right in there somewhere.
I think you were right. That's awesome. So we get Tommy and Brent are dragged 100 million years in the past, and they encounter a pterodactyl. And on page 5, the pterodactyl tries to land on their ship. And Tommy says, I'm going to try to defend us with the laser field. So that's like a shield on Star Trek. Since it disintegrates space junk that crosses our path, maybe it'll do the same for our flying friends. And one of the pterodactyls goes into the ship and gets basically beheaded. I was like, wow.
I mean, as I was going through this comic, pretty much every third page, I've got a note going, bastards, poop on me, poor dinosaur, unnecessary, dead squashed lizard. It's just so unfair to these poor little. All they're doing is living their lives, getting curious about strange things happening around them, or being used by Mr. Evolved Dinosaur Man. It's just wrong.
My first thing went, well, so much for the butterfly effect. Good thing we're not all like different kind of species. Now, maybe that's why we're humans. I don't know. So I didn't get the logic on the next page why Brent had to stay with the ship. And he took the complaining doctor with him, maybe, I guess, to have somebody to talk to.
No, I've no idea whatsoever. I was thinking the same thing, because the doctor, I mean, I'd be complaining as well, but he obviously doesn't understand relative time travel. That, you know,
yes.
It doesn't matter how much they spend in the past, they can go back to where they are.
I know, I love that part.
Yeah, the doctor looks a bit like Julie Schwartz, to be honest.
Yeah, a little bit. Maybe that was part of it. I don't know. Back to the current day. And we get a tremendous amount of carnage in the present day. It reminded me of the disaster comic that reviewed a couple months ago. And you've got dinosaurs crashing through the subway station and another one crashing buildings. I guess what is this one? This is a Gorgosaurus smashing
Bogosaurus.
through Tokyo. I mean, wow, that was something else.
They could have had a little contest for the kids, even see, without naming all the dinosaurs in the story, saying, can you name all the dinosaurs, and just have a little writing contest, give them a prize, or just have something at the end of the issue, a bit of reader participation. Would you have recognized a Gorgosaurus,
I
Paul?
would not have recognized a Gorgosaurus. That one was new to me. I don't know what he looks like. I would have gone to Triceratops and the T-Rex and the pterodactyls and the brontosauruses and things like that. But this guy was a new look for me. I thought it was hysterical he didn't recognize Kronos. I thought that was great.
I don't know, though, because he had, he hung out with super seekers to fight super villains, but he'd been away from Earth for years. If the super villains didn't give him a handbook of super villainy and he's not in there.
Yeah, I know. It happened in an early issues of that he didn't realize was the Green Lantern was the hero and somebody else was the villain, and that's how he got
Yeah,
mixed
he's
up in the
quite
villains in the
naive.
first place.
Yeah, he seems to be sort of very spotty about when his telepathic powers kick in to tell him whether someone's good or
Yeah,
bad.
and I did look it up. This issue is published between issues 6 and 7 of the Secret Societies, both by Ruzakis and Butler, so sort of in between those issues. Page 9 is a cool page. Why don't you tell the listeners about page 9?
Page 9 is a very cool page because it is a montage. In the center of the page, we see Captain Comet, who's apparently looking at the monitor screens, and he sees around the world, he sees Aquaman and Green Lantern fighting probably a plesiosaurus and some kind of killer whale in the mid-Pacific. He sees Wonder Woman and Black Canary in New York at the top of, not the Empire State Building, but the top of some building with apparently a very, very tiny dome, because they're both dwarfing this tiny
I had
dome.
the same note. It's a very tiny top of the building.
Wonder Woman's lassoing a pterodactyl or something. Black Canary's screaming at it. And then, meanwhile, in Tokyo, we have Superman and the Flash fighting some kind of animal, dinosaur.
That's that Gonosaurus. Isn't he in Tokyo?
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, Gorgosaurus. He was in Tokyo. And he's colored yellow here. He was green on page 7.
I say, well, yes, all this implies that, that they went back to the Justice League satellite and got organized into little teams of twos rather than threes. Because it's funny, because on the page before this, we have Hawkman naming Captain Comet an honorary member so that he could watch the monitor screen, because Captain Comet, of course, is so underpowered compared to Hawkman. And why on earth didn't they just summon him as an actual reserve member, a wife, a sidekick, snap a blooming car if he was in the good books that week? It just seems to make no sense.
Then we get to, I don't know if it's my favorite page, but a favorite page, page 10, where we get the introduction of Tyranno. We see a yellow T-Rex wandering around on its back legs, right? And he comes upon the rock that was the comet and evolves instantly into a talking dinosaur man with a unitard and boots.
I
I
don't
love
think even Sean would find this sexy. It's
it.
not, they're not their best shorts. I mean, he's gonna have a dino wedgie.
It's sort of like an old-time Green Lantern tunic without the bottom part.
Yes, it's not too fetching. Then again, before he transformed, he looked like Barney the Purple Dinosaur if he was yellow, so I'm not sure it's not an improvement.
Yeah, I hear you. So then we get a trip of Tommy and the scientist through the woods. They're looking for the rock. And then we get another full-page spread. Why don't you tell us about page 12, Martin?
It's just the excellent splash page. We have Tyranno Rex dominating the page, just standing there with his arms up in the air, sort of, behold sort of movements. And behind him, there's a screen showing images of what's going on around the world, black and white images in some kind of, well, black and white. And we have in the foreground, Professor Schwartz, no, sorry, Professor Schmidt and Tommy Tomorrow. And Schmidt's going, good Lord, what's that? Tommy, call it an educated guess. But I think we found the comet we're after. And in the corner of the page, we have lots of, it looks like we're in Mordor or something, lots of Stegron or something flying around. And there's a lot going on. But also, in front of the screen, behind Tyranno Rex, we have some kind of double dino ornament plonked on top of this strange brown.
When did he have time to make that statue?
I don't know. He's a very talented dinosaur man. Yeah, I don't even know why he decided that it's his god. I suppose it's because it's created him. Are you impressed by this page, sir?
I just love it. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It's just over the top. Dynamic art by Buckler. The situation is wacky. Ruzakis, what more could you ask for, right?
Oh, it's marvelous stuff, honestly.
They decide to get out of there. I am glad they acknowledge, and I can't remember where this was, that not not all these dinosaurs were around at the same time.
Yeah, well done.
So that was well done. That was a good thing for the kids to realize. You get Tommy starts to shoot the dinosaurs with his space gun.
Space gun.
You know, Bob did not back down from, he wrote Tommy straight, but the terminology, the things that they did, all that kind of stuff was very in line with the old stories, which I thought was pretty cool.
It really was, which makes me wonder why they changed the costume, because I'm pretty sure I'm not wrong. This is not an outfit that Tommy and Brent ever wore. Very attractive. Oh, certainly I'm very distracted by looking at Tommy's left arm in the middle of page 13. Does that look a bit out of whack to you?
Ooh, it does. Yeah, it looks like he's really stretching it back.
Maybe he's evolving. He's going to turn into Dino Tommy.
Then what happens? So then we see Captain Comet on the satellite. He decides to go help Kronos down in Sheboygan, but he flies down. He doesn't bother teleporting down for some reason.
I would imagine it's because I think the teleporter is sort of tuned into their DNA or something like that.
Maybe.
He likes to fly through space.
Yeah, that's true. Kronos is pretty powerful in this comic. Was he generally that powerful? Recently, I read the Atom archives and he had some gadgets, but he didn't seem to be quite this powerful.
He's a lot more impressive here. I mean, he's still doing things like poinging clock hands in people's faces, but he's thinking a lot larger. He had this amazing plan involving the Comet, and he's fearless in the face of the superheroes.
Yeah. But Captain Comet just basically impales this poor Brontosaurus with a spear right through the top of the head. And I was like, man.
It's just really, really sad. And he's got a really sad nose. Oh. I mean, I would imagine little kids would be reading this, just crying their eyes out.
But Captain Comet does have the presence of mind to use the proper plural form of Stegosaurus at the bottom of page 16.
A pair of Stegosaurus.
I love it.
Yeah, you got to remember Captain Comet is a librarian. He knows these things.
They battle the dinosaurs for a little bit. He realizes that Kronos is behind the problem. He goes to try to shut the portal. And that's where on 19, Kronos makes his move. And this is where, like you said, he starts throwing numbers from a clock like the Clock King would do at Captain Comet. Surprisingly effective to knock Captain Comet down on page 19.
Yeah, they do look quite sharp, Paul. And he'll have some momentum. I suppose he's like a character in the Doom Patrol that has every power that you don't name. I mean, he's got every power that you can think of to remember to use it. And, you know. I think he was just caught off guard, but that number 11 does look nice on his bottom. In fact, have you noticed the enormous amount of shots of Captain Comet's backside Rich Buckler gives us?
Well, good for him, right?
You like what you like.
Captain Comet's got lots of powers. Apparently, he's immune to all poisons, we find out on page 20.
Which is very handy.
Yeah, they're very handy. I didn't realize that. So then we cut back to the past, where they are running away. They keep shooting the dinosaurs. 22, they blow up another dinosaur on their way back to the ship.
Oh, dear.
They get back finally to the ship on 22.
I've got to say, these dinosaurs are very clean, because page 22, where they kablat that dinosaur with the space gun.
Yeah.
You can see a couple of tiny bits of perhaps dinosaur hide, but they should be covered in organs at this point.
Dinosaurs keep coming after them like real monsters. They get on the ship at the bottom of 23 and they finally escape all these monsters, knocking them off a cliff. And I love the giant arm, bottom of 25, that comes down and scoops that rock right off the altar there.
Yes, I wonder if that was a regular thing in Tommy's books. It's just weird. It looks almost organic.
Yeah, the ship looks small relative to the size of the arm. Maybe that's a foreshortening effect.
Again, there's a surprising lot of gimmicks in what is just a very flat spaceship.
Yeah, really. I love the part where Tyranno jumps onto the rock as it's retracting into the ship. Great twist to get him into the present day.
Yeah.
But so here's a question for you. If you look at the sequence on the following pages, Tyranno apparently kills a number of the crew. But I wasn't aware there was a crew, either before or after, on the ship other than Tommy and Brent.
Oh, right.
Tommy and Brent can't leave their posts as they're trying to navigate.
Yeah.
And the doctor's running back and forth. And meanwhile, there are other bodies on the ground. That's not the doctor, it's not Tommy, and it's not Brent.
I'm ashamed to say I didn't even see those bodies in the middle, at the bottom of page 28. That's terrible. The one at 27 in the back at the bottom of the panel, even though he hasn't got the mustache, I just thought that was Brent temporarily settled. But of course, you're right, Brent's in another room at that point.
Yeah, I don't know why they felt they needed to have more people.
They could have been useful before, and you know, helping Brent look after that, the big giant hand, but I don't know. But actually, also on page 27, how about that strange colouring choice at the top of the page?
Oh, he's yours. Mine is very, it's very faded. It's, I think, an attempt to show a very bright light coming out of the screen, you know, the view screen at the front of the ship.
I really like it. I mean, look, it looks fantastic in the redigitized version.
Yeah, so that's pretty neat. So I did enjoy that. Poor Dr. Schmidt got his arm basically chomped off by Tyranno in the middle of 28.
I think he did. He was surprisingly brave, given how, well, I wouldn't say how coward he's been for the rest of it. I'd say just how normal he's been, because I think most of us would be sort of really very, very frightened.
I'd be running if there were dinosaurs after me.
Yeah.
So then we get the merge of the heroes on 29, where Captain Comet is using one of his other mental powers to try to close this rift. And the spaceship comes through. He's like, how did a futuristic spacecraft wind up in a tunnel in the past? They jump out of the ship, and there's Tyranno, who's got his rock. He says, flee, creatures. Flee from Tyranno Rex. None shall possess my god but I. Then Kronos is like, hey, he's got my comet.
But it is great to see Kronos in such an intense situation, because normally it is just a quick battle of wits with the atom, and then he's gone. He's back in prison. So this was fun.
I love Bob. Sometimes his logic of scratching my head, but I guess if the meteor created Tyranno, Kronos shoots a couple, like, I don't know, clock pointer arrows at the rock to try to take the rock by force, but instead the rock is destroyed and Tyranno is immediately turned back into a regular Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I think that's the science called, we're on page 30 of 34.
Okay.
But it's almost as if the rock is secretly a balloon. It's just been popped.
And, oh, by the way, there's a bunch of purple guys at the top of 30. So there's more crew.
Yeah, that's weird. It's just like, if it's just been popped into the book since I read it last. Goodness me.
Then pretty good action scenes on 31 and 32 by Buckler. That's where Tommy and Captain Comet meet. And Tommy knows exactly who Captain Comet is, which I found pretty funny, given that he's so much in the future and Captain Comet's from the past, but whatever.
Yeah. I like that, yeah.
I did like that, too. Captain Comet doesn't know who Tommy is, of course, pretty up on figuring out who's good and who's not. And he makes it a point to tell us, as I think he did at every issue of the Secret Society, that he's got 1/10 of Superman's powers.
Yeah, that's a bit of a random one.
Yeah. Picks up the T-Rex at the bottom of 32 and going to toss him through the hole as Kronos tries to sneak away.
I was just laughing at sort of him sneaking away like that. You know, he just looks like he's doing a little ballet dance as he's just going off the pants.
He's like,
so delicate.
I better get away.
Yeah.
Throws him to the portal. The portal closes. Kronos tries to get away. But of course, Tommy Tomorrow stops him. And we basically reach the end because we've captured Kronos. And then all we have left is a great end where, just like you said, Neil Adams says, hey, this is a fun story. Rich, can I pencil Superman's face for you? And Rich says, sure. That is Neil Adams all the way.
Yeah. I like, you know, I mentioned before they could have got Snapper Carr to do the monitors. Well, there's Tommy Tomorrow snapping his fingers in the middle of the page, excited to see Superman.
He's Superman. He can fly us right back through time.
Yeah.
I love it. He takes him back. Hawkman, for some reason, well, again, that's not for some reason. Hawkman was often kind of a jerk in these stories where he's like, hey, you left the monitor duty, and how could you do that? And he goes, oh, well, obviously I didn't leave, Hawkman.
I'm yeah, like, I think there's actually a line of dialogues early in the story where Hawkman says something like, hey, being the jerk's my shtick, or something like that.
That's so funny.
And then Captain Comet winks in the last panel. He's doing the Superman wink at him.
I love that, too. That's great. That's finally the end of this awesome story, you know?
Yeah, surely Bob Azarkas, in the first draft, surely he would have sort of had the JLA at that point offer Captain Comet membership. It just seems ridiculous. I mean, he's such a useful hero. He's not, okay, he's currently involved with the SSOV, but you think Captain Comet would say, help me clean up the SSOV once and for all. You know, they're right there. He'll be such an asset.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I think it was Bob was trying to, like, make it happen through osmosis, but either whoever was the writer of the... It was this Englehart or Len Wein or whoever was writing Justice League, I guess. Maybe they didn't like Captain Comet. Who knows?
Yeah, I suppose with this being the double issue type, probably was Englehart or the start of Joey Conway. Probably yeah. Englehart. But I mean, what? Who would you rather have, Captain Comet or the Privateer?
Yeah. So overall, fun story. Definitely special. We'll get to that in a little bit. There's a few little other features I want to talk about. After page 26, there's a great ad for the second round of Dollar Comics, which is neat. It's the world's finest. It's got this great Neil Adams cover where Superman and Batman are looking in the crystal Ball, talking about how he got Superman and Batman, Black Canary, Green Arrow, Vigilante, Wonder Woman, as well as a GI Combat. So it's just a great Dollar Comics. I mean, I loved Dollar Comics when I was a kid. Let me tell you, it's a shame that you didn't get them as they were coming out, because
Very rarely. Yeah, very rarely.
they were awesome.
Well, this is such an unusual advert, because it not only does it have the covers, it just runs down the titles of all the stories, even the little war ones. I mean, I do want to read The Sniper in Skirts.
Mademoiselle Marie, perhaps, who knows? Yeah,
That crossed my mind. You think, well, surely she's famous enough that they would give her a mention.
that's probably true. So then what's great about the Dollar Comics is a little further on, so right facing page 30, we get publishorial. It's not called that yet. I think later on she starts calling her editorials publishorials from Jeanette Kahn. It's a text page basically explaining Dollar Comics to the kids as an adult. Right, looking back, I think it's amazing that the publishers thought they had to do stuff like this to explain their publishing plans. Kid, I ate this up. I'm like, wow, this really makes sense. I get four comics for the price of three. That's fantastic. But I loved this kind of thing when I was a kid. So I don't know, maybe I was weird. I don't know what you thought of this text feature.
I found that absolutely fascinating. I mean, I couldn't believe even in 1976, 77, whatever it was, that they couldn't print a photograph in a comic and make someone look like they weren't in the Phantom Zone.
No, it's terrible.
I thought for years that Jeanette Kahn was Asian based on this picture.
Wow, that's funny. Definitely include a scan of the publishorial in the gallery.
But I think she was being a bit tricky, because when she was talking about how comics had held their price at 10 cents for decades, she didn't mention that at the same time number of actual pages in the comic was going down 64 to 52 to 48 or whatever, 32 in the end.
And then the last one that's neat, an ad for Heroes World. They didn't call it that yet. Visit the superhero shot, from the Kubert School kind of thing, facing the epilogue, page 34, where it does highlight the Michael Fleischer encyclopedias of Batman and Wonder Woman. You got Super Baby plush toys, I guess you would call them, which is really cool. A talking bat clock, which I believe Chris Franklin has.
Of course he does.
Yeah, Chris will correct me if not. Batman's utility belt, and then Color by Number and other books. Fantastic ad.
Do you think that Batman baby? Wait, I don't know whether it's the scariest or the most tragic thing ever.
I think they thought it was too scary to cover his eyes or something, is the only thing
Ah,
I can
could
think
be.
of. And I'll put this one in there too, because it's kind of fun. It basically Batman outfit on a baby, but the cowl only goes up to his forehead. It's got little tiny horns sticking out, almost a little more like Daredevil than Batman. So pretty weird looking.
Oh, is that Bat-Chucky?
Yeah, Bat Chucky. Did you ever see any of this kind of merchandise, Martin?
No, not really. We might get the occasional coloring book, but that was about it.
How about those encyclopedias? I got the Batman one for Christmas one year, soft cover. Did you get any of that stuff?
I've got the Michael Fleischer one on Superman and Batman, but I haven't got the Wonder Woman one. But similarly, as you can never ever in the UK find a copy of Shazam from the 30s and the 70s. I don't think it exists over here.
Yeah, that's tough to find here. Yeah. I mean, you can find it. It's just more expensive. Batman and the Superman 30s to the 70s, I read all the time when I was a kid. That's how I was introduced to
Did
a
yours
lot.
drop to bits? Very could your mine just drops to bits every time.
Yeah, mine just fell apart because I read them a lot, and they're just some great books growing up.
I was such an intelligent 8-year-old when I got it that I believed it was all the stories from the 30s to the 70s.
That's so cute. But we're not done, listeners. We have two other text features in this comic book. And the first one has caricatures of Bob Brazakis on the right with a big exclamation point. He should have had a question mark for it, but who knows?
Actually, to be fair, there is a question mark in the first word balloon and
That's
the
true.
exclamation mark from Bob Brazakis.
Yeah, that's true. Good point, because the guy on the left is Paul Levitz saying, "Do you like dinosaurs?" And Bob Brazakis is going, "Huh?" And it's entitled "The Story Behind the Story" by Bob Brazakis, and it's a bit of a filler.
A bit.
A lot of stuff of, oh, he said this, and then I didn't know what he meant, and kind of modestly funny. But I did like the caricatures at the top. What
Actually,
about
yeah,
you?
because I think I like the character, because the Bob one, that was the one they used on the Answer Man, wasn't it? And
Yeah.
heaven knows who did the Paul Levitt one. But that's so funny when you compare the pictures you see him of nowadays. He looks
Yeah.
much much happier. But yeah, I like this. I mean, Bob, he was DC's answer to Marvel's Bill Mantlo, always ready with a fun comment in the story. So you can't blame Paul Levitt for getting onto him when he needed someone to presumably quite quickly fill 34 pages of story. And it's interesting to think that Paul Levitt apparently just wanted 34 pages filled with dinosaur and any heroes would do.
Yeah.
In which case, I'm surprised that Bob chose Tommy Tomorrow first, he says here, and that it was Levis who suggested putting in Captain Comic, because you'd think Bob Rozsiorkis, given that he was writing Adam Blake in Secret Society of Supervillains, you'd think he'd have seen the opportunity to plug his regular book and said, hey, can we have Adam Blake? And then Rozsiorkis would have said, hey, Captain Comic is about a comet. It's, yeah. It's just very odd, because they could have had on the cover on the pages of Secret Society of Supervillains, because yeah. That cover isn't busy enough with copy.
Yeah, nobody would have noticed if they had more. No, I agree with you. It's not the way I would have thought it went down, but it was interesting, but it was quite a lot of filler. Conversely, this facing page is basically a history of Tommy Tomorrow. A lot of the stuff that I mentioned in my little history talks about the switch from 1988 to 2050 and keeping me at 150 years. And that you mentioned earlier how Bob picked 2056 for this story so that Tommy was sort of in the prime of his career, even though the outfits don't match. But I don't know, I thought it was kind of neat.
It was fun. It's weird to think that there was a period that thought that we readers would know when the prime of Tommy Tomorrow's career was, because he was always just cool as he was intelligent. He had a space gun. He wore shorts. It's madness. And I mean, I do just resent the fact that I didn't. Well, no, I don't resent it, because I loved looking at the stories. The fact that I didn't get rewarded by finding out that, yes, there was a story in which Professor was going to solve something with a space virus. Because is that not the entire implication of that? That it says this happened between somewhere in a story that year. So you think there's going to be Professor Schmidt, but he wasn't mentioned on the comic database. He wasn't in the comics. Tommy's having amazing adventures with little men who live in his fridge.
You would think that, you know, maybe that Vega 4 adventure was a real one, but apparently not, right?
Yeah, but one other thing, I mean, common sense would dictate that Paul Levitch wrote this unsigned page. But given the depth of knowledge, I know Paul Levitch was one of the first fanzine people and he knew a lot. But this, to me, totally reads like E. Nelson Bridwell. I mean, especially the attempt to fit it into the classic Tommy Cannon. That's a joke for British listeners, Tommy Cannon. But that just screams ENB.
Yeah, I agree with 100%. I mean, any of these three guys could have written it, but I agree. It feels like an E. Nelson Bridwell.
Yeah, but it was just love for your money. You got the great big story, fantastic new cover, a couple of text pages, and okay, at the time readers weren't as excited as we are now, just old comic book ads, but what a fantastic value read this was.
So I guess you're going to agree with me that this comic lived up to its special billing?
It did. I mean, this comic is so good. I would say, yes, you can read it if you have the DC membership to read things online. But I would say, spend a few dollars, a few quid, get your own copy, because it's a brilliant package. And it's very much one of my favorite of all the DC specials.
It's great. And it was definitely on the short list. Martin called this one very early on. It just took us a while to get to it. But this is a great comic book. I remember being excited about it, enjoying it. You know, it was tied into both the Secret Society and the Justice League, which I was reading both of them. So it's just good all around. So
it really is. The only thing that could have made it better is if Tyranno Rex joined the baseball team.
Yeah, and you can't go wrong with Bob Rozsiorkis this time, you know, because it's just fun to read.
I hope that he sometimes hears it. In fact, we know from Batman Family Reunion that Bob knows how much we enjoyed his stories.
I hope so. Yeah. So, Martin, thank you so much. This was a barrel of fun. I really appreciate you joining me on this podcast. Can you remind everybody how they can maybe get in touch with you or listen to you somewhere else?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky or X, whatever it's called these days. Don't know why I'm still there, but there I am. Under at Mart Gray. I'm on the Facebook. I've got a blog called Too Dangerous for a Girl, where I do a few reviews here and there. I pop up in the comments on the Fire and Water pages. I mean, if you're looking for me, just click your heels together three times while holding a comic book, and I shall appear from a mirror.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up. For everybody else, I'm going to play a short promo, and when I return, I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Digging for Kryptonite is a weekly podcast series hosted by yours truly, Anthony Desiato, examining Superman's vast mythology across time and media. If you have a favorite story, creator, or adaptation, chances are we've covered it over the past 200 plus episodes. I've interviewed creators including Mark Waid, Dan Jurgens, Jeff Loeb, Joe Kelly, and many more. Whether you're a lifelong Superman fan like me, or you're new to the character, we have you covered. Subscribe to Digging for Kryptonite wherever you get podcasts, and remember, it's about what you do. It's about action.
Welcome back. Before we get into feedback, I just wanted to tell everybody what a great time I had at the Baltimore Comic Con a couple of weeks ago. On Friday, as is tradition for the last 4 years, I met up with my Bat brother, Sean M. Myers, for lunch before the con. But this time, we were joined by a whole bunch of other podcasters and friends. I finally got to meet the irredeemable Shag in person after having known him as part of the network for so long. There were a bunch of other folks at lunch, too. Tim Price, Bill Beer, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Rick Heineken, and Steve Givens. We went into the con, and the first thing I did was go see Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, and get him to sign my copy of the DC Style Guide coffee table book that came out earlier this year. That was cool, and Sean took a picture of me fanboying that I will include in the gallery. That night we had dinner, and we were joined by Stella Bowman and Harry Shute, as well as Michael Lane from the Comics in the Golden Age, and our pal and network all-star, Brett Young, who couldn't make the con but drove up an hour and a half just to have dinner with us. And I also got to meet Captain Entropy and his wife, Mrs. Neg Entropy, for the first time in person, which was a thrill. And most of these folks also had dinner again on Saturday night. Overall, great experience. I'm just really fortunate to be part of this podcasting community. Can't wait till we do something like this again. All right, now another thing I want to comment on briefly. About a month or so ago, we had our Avengers Draft episode over on FW Presents. Since I was a showrunner, I promised to make a few comments about that episode on DC Specialcast. It was great fun for all involved, and we had a tremendous turnout of comments. So first of all, thank everybody for that. Thank you. We had 28 different listeners comment and vote, and thus be eligible for the drawing. Of those 28, the results of the vote were as follows. Tim and Sean's team each got 5 votes as favorite Avengers lineup. Ryan and I each got 4 votes. Shag and Brett each got 3 votes. 4 listeners didn't pick a team, but they were still eligible for the drawing. A lot of the listeners tossed out their own teams as well, which was really fun to read and respond to. So thanks again for such great community involvement. Not sure when the next one of these will be, but I'm sure we'll try something like it again. And as far as the t-shirt winner, of the 28 eligible listeners, the random generator fell on Joe X. I will be contacting him and arranging for him to get the t-shirt of his choice. Congratulations to Joe, and thanks again to everybody for listening and participating. All right, finally, we have our next episode announcement. Can you believe it will be December already? And of course, that means the holidays are here, which means Christmas comics. And I will be talking about one of the best ones, if not the very best one, DC Special Series number 21, The Superstar Holiday Special. That issue has 5 holiday tales starring Batman, Jonah Hex, House of Mystery, Sergeant Rock, and the Legion of Superheroes. Good news, it is on DC Universe Infinite for those who want to read it before listening to the show. And to celebrate our first year of DC Specialcast, I will be joined by not one, not two, three, or four, but 5 superstar guests. 4 of my past guests and Fire and Water All-Stars, Brett Young, Ryan Daly, Rob Kelly, and Chris Franklin, each will take on one of the 5 stories with me. But my 5th guest is a very special family member. That's right, it is the return to podcasting of my Bat brother, Sean M. Myers. And we will also have a very special announcement, for real this time. So look for it on Sunday, December 7th. Now, let's get to your comments about our last episode, DC Special Cast number 10, The Ghost Special with my guest, Chris Franklin. I got an email from Billy Dunleavy this month, host of the Monsters and Magazine podcast. Billy was also at the Baltimore Comic Con. Weirdly, I didn't run into him. Sorry, Billy, next time. Billy said, "Hey, Paul, loving the show with its wide array of books. I'm a terrible feedbacker, but rest assured I'm listening and enjoying the show. You've had great guests on so far, and I'm definitely looking forward to more in the future. Your latest episode was a lot of fun, as I really enjoy the horror comics. Plus, Chris is a fantastic guest. Super knowledgeable guy, plus an all-around good dude. No question about that. Thanks, Billy." Couple quick hits from social media. James Williams made a comment as he reposted the show. He said, "The amount of research you do each episode makes this one of the best podcasts around. Every episode has been terrific." Thank you, James. That is very kind of you to say. And from Marcus Sorois, he said, "Ghosts? No way, man. I heard if you read the comic after midnight, the ghosts come out and haunt your house." True story. It happened to my friend's cousin's girlfriend from Canada. Thanks, Marcus. Would love to hear more details on that. And from John Stibe, "Just in time for spooky season comes the latest episode of one of my favorite podcasts, Turn the Lights Down Low and Find Your Fear." So I do thank all of you who helped spread the word about the podcast on social media. Now let's get to your comments on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So remember, this is the best place to leave comments if you want to make sure I read them. I try to catch all the social media stuff, but I may miss that, some of those from time to time. First up, Rob McCarthy says, "Yeah, there's nothing so 70s as a ghost-powered CB radio." "Great story about the flaming car, Chris. And I'm guessing the lion attack got past the comics code because it was a dream." So maybe so, Rob. Good points. Ito Boznar said, fun show, gentlemen. I never had this specific issue, but your conversation, as well as the gallery page, certainly makes this one seem like something I'd like to read. The story drawn by Nino in particular looks really nice, but then I'm a big fan of his art. In fact, probably the only artwork he ever did that I didn't like was in that Batman story from the annual that Chris mentioned. Other than that, though, he's always produced top-notch work in my book. On Jerry Grandinetti, yes, his work in the story you covered does sort of bring to mind Frank Robbins, but he's done far better work. I know there were a few times I thought I could see Will Eisner's influence in his art. And yes, Chris, I'm very much old enough to remember Merv Griffin, In Search Of. I watched that pretty regularly for a while. And CB Radio. I recall the latter in particular was such a crazy big fad for a while in the late 70s, and then just as quickly seemed to disappear from the public consciousness. Thanks for your comments, Ito. My co-host on the Sandman Slept Here, Fire and Water All-Star Ryan Daly says, of the various horror anthologies published by DC, Ghosts was my least favorite. It was, however, the book I could most frequently find in the cheap bins. Good episode, guys. Thanks, Ryan. Super Captain said, I wasn't a particularly big fan of DC's horror comics, but I did pick up a few issues of The Unexpected. I especially remember number 190, and I would buy weird war tales from time to time. I especially enjoyed the Creature Commandos and the War That Time Forgot. I think I'm just a little older than Chris Franklin, so I too remember Merv Griffin and Search Of and CB radios. Heck, my family had a CB radio back in the late 70s, and I can still sing all the words to Convoy by C.W. McCall. Speaking of TV series about strange and unusual phenomena, did anyone else watch Arthur C. Clarke's World of Strange Powers? Wikipedia identifies it as originating on ITV and was shown here in the States on various PBS channels. I'm sure I discovered it watching Doctor Who in the mid-80s. Each episode focused on ghosts, stigmata, ESP, psychokinesis, and other such things. Great show, Paul and Chris. I always feel like I learned something from y'all. Thanks, Super Captain. And Martin Gray pipes in. He said, I remember Mysterious Worlds. It always seemed to start off with Arthur C. Clarke walking along a beach near his home in Bermuda or wherever. What a show-off. Bucky749 piped in. He said, I've read a few horror anthologies, mainly some Skywald reprints that I was lucky enough to get, but I tend to like stories better when they have a host. You should check out the shows Cinema Insomnia and Sally the Zombie Cheerleader on YouTube. Thanks for the recommendations, Buck. Future guest Movie Matt Saroy says, Ghosts. It sounds scary, but I ain't afraid of no ghosts. It was stories like this, though, that actually helped me get over my fears of spectral apparitions. As long as I didn't ignore the warnings, visit abandoned mansions, get cursed by a shaman, or murder anybody, I'd be safe from ghosts. The stories in Ghosts were just as much morality plays as the superhero adventures that got me reading comics. If you did bad things would happen to you. I didn't read a lot of ghost comics since it was canceled not long after I started reading comics, but the horror anthology I remember most was the rebranded House of Mystery, Elvira's House of Mysteries. I'm glad you conquered your fears, Matt. Next up, past guest, network co-founder, and a noted film historian, Rob Kelly says, I almost never read Ghosts. It always looks so dull, even compared to House of Mystery or The Unexpected. It always seems like one of those titles DC published just to take up rack space or fulfill obscure postal regulations. Of course, that's not fair, and the pages you posted do look more interesting than I would ever have given the series credit for. Interesting that the book sold so well that it got its own issue of DC Special. As an aside, Rob, at the editor's panel I attended at the Baltimore Comic Con, a point of conversation was that Murray Boltonoff's titles like The Brave and the Bold and Ghosts outsold the other Batman books and the Orlando Misery books in the early 70s. He had some kind of magic, that's for sure. Back to Rob. I did love the panel of the guy getting a lion's paw right in the face. And Chris, I can't believe the network hasn't heard the Car on Fire story before. Yeah, that was amazing. Chris is the real superhero around here. Guest on this very episode, my pal from the other side of the pond, Martin Gray, commented, it was great to have another episode, and Chris is always great value. The Leo Dorfman focus was great. I bought hundreds and hundreds of these DC mystery books, including Ghosts, but I never saw this one, unfortunately. It does sound like the stories aren't above average, but sometimes the averages are high. The More People sounds like a great time. If Snark did exist, I'd be heading there right now. Now, I've almost certainly told this story on the network previously, but I may have got the subtitle of Ghosts changed. It always bugged me that the cover said True Tales, but in Indicia there was the usual disclaimer about the characters and events being made up. So I wrote to Bat-Cousin Bob Rozakis, the answer man, and was published in the Daily Planet on the 5th of February, 1979. There was my question, are the stories that appear in Ghosts true? If so, why the line in Indicia about, quote, the stories, characters, and events mentioned are entirely fictional from Little Martin Gray? And the answer was, our ghost raiders research their hauntings as much as possible, though they often change names to protect innocent parties. As for the truth in the tales, it depends on whether you believe in ghosts or not. Martin goes on, he says, as it turns out, 2 months previously, the true had been replaced by new. Spooky coincidence? And Martin sent me a nice photo summary of the covers of Ghosts and the Answer Man bit, and I've included that picture in the gallery, so check it out. Back to Martin. That DC Finest Kryptonite Nevermore book you recommended, Paul, actually has a cracking ghost story in it set in the Tower of London, the ghost of Clark Kent. Oh yeah, that was a good one, Martin. I read that a month or so ago. That was great. And Art Saff drew some Supergirl stories too, you know. That's right. And you boys don't know Tenney Henson. Did you not listen to Ryan and me talk about him on the epic Midnight to Podcasting Hour, number 11, back in 2017, when we discussed the unexpected number 202's legendary What Comes Hopping Down the Bunny Trail? Martin, I probably did listen to that show 8 years ago. And then finally, if you want some Pete Ross talk, check out episode 213 of the Digging for Kryptonite podcast from July, in which host Anthony DeSoto and I go deep into Pete Ross's sodden tent. As always, Martin, thank you for your comments and thanks for being on this episode. Past and future guest Dr. Ange says, I love the mystery titles with their horrific twist endings and You Reap What You Sow, Supernatural Justice. Of all of them, I bought Unexpected the most. Ghost was the least purchased, but I did get it now and then. There is some real gold in this issue. The Totem Pole story is great. The Horror Moon reminded me of the Atlantis Chronicles' Death Meteor. But nothing beats the Lion Paw to the Face. Brutal. Young Ange would have been giddy. Gotta love all the references here. CB Radios, We Got Ourselves a Convoy, The Merv Griffin Show, but best of all, the Science Proves the Psychic Self. Insanity. Great episode and great discussion. Thank you, Ange. Special cast's very own DJ Matthew Davis says, another fun episode, guys, even though this wasn't about the spectral remnants of TV's Woodstone Manor. Although Lady Glinda in the Moors story does resemble Hetty a little bit. Boy, Matthew, I should have made that connection. Great call out. Back to Matthew. Having recently deceased loved ones in the home was a thing 100 years ago. The front entry room was referred to as a parlor, and that was where guests were greeted and entertained. When there was a death, this was where the body would lay for mourners to pay their respects before the funeral. This may also be where the term funeral parlor came from. Boom, Matthew, bring in the knowledge. That is great info. Thank you, Matthew. A question about last month's episode. Did Jack Kirby ever produce an origin for Light Ray? I haven't read all the original Fourth World stories. Just wondering if this was a retelling, an expansion of the origin, or a brand new story. Matthew, I've read most of that stuff. I don't think so, but it's been a while and I could certainly be wrong. So if I am wrong, please somebody correct me in the comments. Anyway, thanks for the great comments, Matthew. Jeff Owens pipes in next and says, hi, Paul. I enjoyed this episode as always, and I want to thank Chris Franklin for mentioning the Hollywood Hauntings feature that was sometimes published within the pages of Ghosts. It wasn't as easy as you'd think to find out what issue it was, but I narrowed down the appearance of Vincent Price to number 62. As luck would have it, my weekend activities included visiting a local comic book convention, and I purchased that very comic for my collection. I featured it on October 12th during the annual Countdown to Halloween for my blog, The Classic Horrors Club, and gave DC Special Cast a shout-out wherever I could. Wow, that's awesome, Jeff. Great story, and thank you for the support. Listeners, you should definitely check out his blog. My buddy Dan Doherty says, great stuff again. I can't keep expanding my collecting focus to this title. I just can't. But this podcast makes it very tempting. Come on, Dan. With all the comics you have, what's a few more? And finally, Fire and Water bartender Brett Young says, great show, Paul and Chris. I never read Ghosts, but I do appreciate them being direct about what kind of stories they're telling. Interesting collection of stories in this issue. The more people coming to town once a year reminds me of the caddies getting 15 minutes in the pool at the Bushwood Country Club at Caddy Shack. Always fun climbing up on Uncle Paul's knee to learn the story of a different creator. It's a shame Mr. Dorfman didn't live long enough to cash in on that sweet Pete Ross money. And I agree with Chris that the art on the Totem story was a lot of fun. While I'm sure books like Ghost didn't get the superstar artists, it did provide other artists with the opportunity to do some unique storytelling. Great show. Thanks, Brett. And it was great to catch up in person. Thanks again and talk to you next month. All right, everybody, that's it for the comments. A reminder that if you're enjoying what you hear on this show, any of our network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode, special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts, and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. My thanks once again to Martin Gray for appearing on this episode. Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you will join me and 5 all-star guests next month on DC Special Cast as we kick off the holiday season with the Superstar Holiday Special.